Yes, I must have this thing. Hi, everybody. My name's Maureen, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Maureen.
And I didn't get nervous until they read the preamble. And I got all that six-step stuff going through my brain right now, so I'm going to try and bring it all back and bring it all back. I went in the bathroom, and I prayed. And so the couple things I'm going to say first to get the business part of this out of the way, anything I do say here today is strictly my opinion. It's my experience, my strength, and my hope. It's what it used to be like for me, what happened, and what it's like now. Unless I'm reading out of this book, and then it's the opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is March the 17th, 1990. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. Well, we kind of sponsor one another, and I sponsor others. And I have a home group. It's the Fort Hill Big Book Group. We meet Monday, twice on Friday, and Saturday in Lynchburg, Virginia. So, and I also have a home group in New Jersey. It's the Live Easy But Think First group of the Kearney Sunday night. So, again, I got sober in New Jersey. I spent most of my drunkenness in New Jersey. I took it to other places, but I started drinking basically at a very young age because it was okay. You know, it was okay to take the foam and the sips off of daddy's beer. It was okay when they were having a party to take a sip of a whiskey sour, even though I probably did the sour dance after taking a sip. You know, but my real, real honest, you know, weekend warrior kind of stuff and all that kind of stuff started in the eighth grade, summer of eighth grade. You know, Mad Dog 2020, Wild Irish Rose, you know, my brothers would, I have five brothers. I come from a large Irish Catholic family, and that probably qualifies me automatically. However, I'm the only one in this thing. My brothers and sisters don't have a problem with alcohol. You know, my sister can have a glass of wine, and she says, I'm going out to have a drink tonight. You don't call that drinking, really? Because really, really, you want to see drinking? I can show you drinking. You know, my brothers would go, and we'd give them, you know, all kinds of quarters and nickels and dimes, and they would get us a quart of beer, and, you know, they would take the rest of the money and go do whatever it is they were doing. We learned very early how to get alcohol, whether we were, you know, going to go camping in the woods, and, you know, one of my brothers were going to, you know, fill a cooler for us, or, you know, we would have it delivered by the truck. There was a local liquor store in my hometown, and we would call and put this big order in, and this guy would come and deliver it, and we'd pay him in nickels and dimes and quarters. You'd think they would have caught on. But we'd holler upstairs, Dad, we'd have somebody upstairs with the shower running, and we'd holler upstairs, Dad, the guy from Monaco's was here. And the guy upstairs would holler down, just pay him out of my wallet. And we'd give him a bag full of silver. But while he was delivering that, we were paying him, and he was checking the silver, we also had a couple of guys going around and getting a couple six-packs out of the back. You know, so we always got extra out of there. And, you know, and I, you know, again, the mind of the alcoholic. When I want to get the booze, I'm going to get it, you know. And it progressed. And it just progressed. It wasn't rapid. It wasn't insane. It wasn't, you know, consequences weren't so severe. You know, my father was a fireman locally. And, you know, when you got in trouble and the police saw you, they would say, when I run into your dad, I'm going to tell him. You know, now get your butt home. Or, you know, you weren't disrespectful to the neighbors because, again, you didn't want the consequences. And it wasn't so much of, you know, you knew that there was going to be consequences. So you just, you know, you got the look and you knew you had to stop, you know. It was a lot of fun. I played sports. So, you know, we were a traveling softball team, a traveling basketball team. You know, in my late teens, there was a the Son of Sam was all on the loose up there in New Jersey and New York, and we were playing basketball. And, you know, again, you know, we're in Jersey City, and they're evacuating us out of Jersey City because Son of Sam was another sighting. But we didn't care. Evacuate us out, and we're just going to get the beer. It didn't matter because the beer was waiting for us at the end of the game. Circumstances started to progress. But I felt like that, still that outsider looking in. You know, I always felt that something wasn't quite right. Something didn't quite connect. So the sports took us to other places and state finals and, you know, beer on the bus. Coaches bought it for us. Again, it wasn't a big deal. But the geographical cure, I had to take it because I still wasn't comfortable in my skin. I lived in North Jersey, just outside the Meadowlands, and my brother was a police officer down in Atlantic City. And I decided that, you know, he had said, you know, just come stay with me and Jill for a little while and see if you can get it together, see if you can get it together. So I did. I moved into his house, and it's really where it started, really, to progress a little bit more rapid, more trouble with the police, because now I didn't have the local connection of my father getting me out of trouble or my other brothers getting me out of trouble or, you know, knowing that, well, you're Joe Whittle's little sister, I'll let you go this time, or, you know, that kind of stuff. So I was driving one time on a Garden State Parkway, and I passed out in the toll booth, and, you know, we were just kind of talking about this on the way here. I'd been drinking since, like, I don't even know, 10 o'clock in the morning, and it's now 2 o'clock in the a.m. the next morning, or 3 o'clock, whatever, and I knew I had paid the toll, because when the police officer banged on the window and told me to pull over, the toll light was green. Or maybe they made it green for me, I don't know. But he told me to get out of the car, and I got out of the car, and he said, do you know it's also illegal to drive in bare feet? And I slapped him, and I said, these are not bare feet. They're human feet. Do these feet look big, brown, and hairy to you? And he had no sense of humor. Zero. Zilch. yeah. Yeah, so he took me down to the drunk tank, and, you know, the guy that was in the drunk tank asked me for a shot of something. Can I get a little something? I said, sure, I keep spare of my sock. And I was like, they took my socks. You know, what kind of suicide watch is this place? And, you know, I was just giving these police officers a run for their money. And by the time I did the breathalyzer, three times, and, you know, blew a .4, blew a .4 point, blew .4 point, and it just kept going higher and higher and higher and higher because the alcohol was just cooking me. And, you know, the police officer said, you realize you should be dead. You know, you should toxically have drowned yourself in alcohol. And I was like, well, you're just going to have to kill me then. You know what I mean? I was just obnoxious and incredible. And, again, this brother came and he picked me up and you know, we didn't see it as enabling. He was just the big brother taking care of the little sister. A couple of years later, I moved back from that town because, again, I'm burning these bridges with these police officers, these local police officers, and my brother's saying, you got to cut this out, man. You're ruining my reputation. Screw your reputation. I didn't care. Had no bearing on what I did or how I did it. You know, because, again, they can't blame you for my actions. How can they do that? You know, how could they do that? And just because I don't want the white picket fence and the 2.3 children and the, you know, $40,000 a year job and all this other stuff, I'm still living right. I'm living right. I moved into this little town of Sweetwater, New Jersey. It was this little isolation hole. I could do what I wanted, when I wanted, where I wanted, and whenever. And, you know, the police force was one. You know, it was like a Barney Fife kind of town. And, you know, again, it was, the alcoholism was taking my life and shrinking it and shrinking it and shrinking it and shrinking it and shrinking it. And I didn't know it. And then in December of 1984, I was 24 years old, and my mother died. And my alcoholism went from the fun, the play, the can't wait to tell my friends, wait until I tell them what I told the police officer last night, that stuff, you know, my brother getting me out of trouble or not getting me out of trouble, you know, the free-flying, fun-filled, you know, moving and shaking where it came to booze, changed. And I became a daily drinker. I couldn't get enough. There wasn't enough booze. One was too many, a thousand's not enough. There wasn't enough. There was never enough. Whether I spent $100 that night or $1,000 that night, it just wasn't enough. So I started to add other chemicals. Blackouts became a whole lot longer. I love blackouts. I don't know about you guys, but I love them. I love the fact that, you know, it took shorter time from paycheck to paycheck, I think. You know, wow, it's payday again? How'd that happen? Oh, yeah. You know, I love the bars, the smelly, the... You know, there's a bar in Lynchburg called the World Famous Stadium Inn. I have never been in there, but I know what it smells like. I know what it smells like. And let me tell you something. I can sit outside with my car windows up, and I can just look over at that building, and I know what it smells like in there. And I love that. I am drawn to that. The darker, the danker, the... Oh, man. Old men smell like urine and vomit and all. Yeah, I love that. I love that. That's my world. That's where I identify the best. That's, whoa. Forget the hamburgers. They said they got great hamburgers. I don't know. I don't know about that. So, you know, from that point on, incomprehensible demoralization just increased. It increased and increased and increased and increased. You know, my sister-in-law, who was married to my brother, that was a police officer. I have another brother that's a police officer. But she would say to me, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? Can't you just have two? Can't you just have two? Can't you just come to the christening, have two, act normal, and then whatever? No, I don't know how to have just two. And if you're going to limit me, then I'd rather not come. So then they got to the point where they knew that I couldn't just have two, so and they couldn't limit me because I'd probably have 10 or 12 before I got there, have the two that they limited me to. Now I'm already off to the races, so it didn't matter. So again, then they got to the point where they didn't tell me about it anymore. I'd hear about the christenings 2 weeks after it was over. Or, you know, my sister's getting married. Your sister's getting married, and, you know, she asked me to be the maid of honor, and her only requirement is do not show up here with a hangover. Okay. Showed up drunk. Full face. Blown drunk. I'm not hungover. I'm not hungover. I didn't know. I didn't know about the chaos. I didn't know. I didn't know about the confusion and the chaos and the tornado that I was ripping through their lives. I had no idea. I had no idea. I would, if you just leave me alone, then you wouldn't have to worry about me. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. Leave me be. Leave me be. So I moved from South Jersey back to North Jersey, and I was living in my sister's basement because I was going to be the hero and help her with childcare. She had two children at the time. My niece was 5 weeks old. I call her my drunk baby because, again, you know, I would drive under the influence, and, you know, the baby was in the car, and, you know, I did a lot of things that I wasn't proud of, and, you know, and my sister never wanted to hear it. She would say to me, yeah, you can use my car, but don't drink, or you got to give the keys over to whoever happens to be on the other end. And I'd say, okay, and I'd give the person my keys, but I'd have them back in my pocket after 5 minutes or so, you know, just to make sure that, you know, I had my escape route or whatever. So it started to turn into regular insanity and just getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And that hole inside of here, I couldn't fill it. Nothing I could do could fill it. I just couldn't fill it. And to me, it didn't matter. You know, it didn't matter. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone. I have another sister, one sister who... She really witnessed all of it. She was the one of the only ones that wouldn't turn me away, whether I came home, you know, after a 10-day binge or a, you know, 15-day binge and left on Tuesday, come back on, you know, the following Monday, whatever. You know, she would always just go sleep it off and cut it out. And you got to knock it off. And that, you know, I mean, she lectured me, but she still allowed the door always to be open no matter what shape or condition I was in. And, you know, her and I just had this emotional conversation when I was home in New Jersey in May. And, you know, it's pretty awesome that you can get down to an emotional level with your sister these days and it doesn't have to involve booze. Because remember those 3 a.m. phone calls that everybody always wanted to hear about? How much I care about you. Do you know how much I meant? You know, those drunk dials, you know. I'm just so grateful that I can have a level of honesty with my family today, And it does get emotional, and it can change, you know, the relationships. And, you know, we're a pretty tight crew today because I'm not causing the chaos. When I first got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought my family was dysfunctional. Really did for a long time, probably 7, 8, 10 years. You know, I would identify the dysfunctional family and tell everybody how dysfunctional my family was, you know. And guess what? They're not dysfunctional. I was the dysfunction. But it took me a long time to figure that out. Because, again, if you would just leave me alone, because I don't want that life that you think I should be living, leave me be. You know, the nights I had to sleep under bridges or around a barrel in Penn Station in New York and North New Jersey. And it's funny because one night in an AA meeting, we were going to pick up this 12-step call, and he was coming into Penn Station. And, you know, we were all running around, trying to get this drunk on this 12-step call. And, you know, there was like four of us at different exits. It had blizzard. There was a blizzard going on, and we got to go get him. And, you know, the lengths you go to now to stay sober. And, you know, the next night when we were doing the Lord's Prayer, the four of us said, "Lead us not into Penn Station," instead of "Lead us not into Penn Station." So again, you know, take everything with a grain of salt and have a sense of humor. So again, the drinking just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, and I didn't understand it. I didn't understand why I could not go and have just two. I had no clue. I had no clue that one was too many and 1,000 wasn't enough. I was clueless. So at the very end, that long stretch, that 6-year stretch, it was really a 6-year stretch where my alcoholism was just full-blown alcoholism. I mean, I wasn't even 30 years old yet. How can I be? You know, I am not an alcoholic. Alcoholics are people who live under the bridges. I only spent one night there once in a while. Alcoholics are the guys who live on the park benches. I only spend one night there once in a while. I slept in Salvation Army boxes for shelters. You know, alcoholics and drunks, the town drunks, they don't think to go to the Salvation Army box for shelter. They're on the park bench for night after night after night after night after night. If they were smart, they'd go to the Salvation Army box or the Goodwill box and climb in. It's nice and comfortable. It's warm. There's a lot of things in there, sweaters and socks and things you can put on. The hard part is getting back out the next day. That's the hard part. No ideas. You know, guys don't need them. You have your own. So, you know, and my sister kept getting angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier. So I went up to, I have two aunts. They were nuns who came out of the, we like to call it broke the habit. they left the order, you know, when Vatican II came into play, they left the order. Again, we still like to say break the habit. So they lived up in a place called Columbia, New Jersey, and I'd gone up a couple of times to help them do some stuff. And, you know, one night late at night, I'd said to my one aunt, I said, "Aunt Cher, I think I might have a drinking problem." And my other aunt was out of the bedroom in a shot. And she sat down on the end of the couch, and she said, "You don't have a drinking problem, sweetie. You're an alcoholic. You're sick, and you need help." Whoa! So the next morning, we went to church, and we're standing outside of church, and you know, we come down the stairs of this cathedral that they belong to, and we're down, and I'm down on the ground floor, and they're up there, and the priest is standing behind them, greeting people. And my aunt's talking to somebody, and she gives her the where and when in New Jersey is about the size of a grapevine. And she has it, I see my aunt with it in her hand, and she's got it rolled up. And she's talking to this woman, and they're both looking down at me, and they're looking. Talk about incomprehensible demoralization. It was bad. It was bad. But it turned out that it was a meeting book. So we went back to my aunt's house, and I had promised her that I would try a meeting, and she said, "No, you won't. You won't try a meeting. You'll be here on Tuesday night. Go in the book, find a meeting on Tuesday night, and you and I are going to go to a meeting, and we're going to go together." What did I know about an AA book? So I picked a meeting, And we got there, and the man said, would you like to read the steps? I said, sure. I read them and handed them back to him. It was a closed meeting, and now they were able to tell that it's a closed meeting because I just read the steps and handed them back. And how did they know? How did they know I don't belong? But my aunt refused to adjourn until they helped me. She said, I don't care if you got to vote. I don't care if you got to whatever you got to decide. Her and I are not leaving. I will not leave this. So you got to adjourn your meeting. You got to send for the police. You got to do whatever it is you've got to do. And this is an aunt who broke a habit. You're going to help her. I'm not leaving here until it happens. I'd like to say that I got sober that night, but I didn't. But there was a seed that was planted, and I was willing to hang around a little bit. I stopped on my way home at a place called the Thirsty Moose, if anybody knows anything in New Jersey. It's on Route 15. Great beer, great choices. I was only going to have two. They are this big. Nice beer glass. Nice. And again, telling my family, nope, I'm only going to do two. I'm doing that AA thing, so I'm able to have two. I'm just not allowed to get drunk. Because my family didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know anything about AA. Who knew? They don't have this issue. My sister can have a glass of wine and leave this much. Who does that? We could be out to dinner. My brother-in-law has a glass of whatever he has, Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, whatever it is he happens to be drinking, and take one or two sips out of it and leaves it. Who does that? I not only make sure mine is finished, but if you left some, I'm going to get it before we leave. You know, how many New Year's Eve people left the champagne? Not on my watch. You know. So again, I was coming around, did a Thanksgiving meeting. That was in August. I did a Thanksgiving gratitude meeting. There was 230 people in this huge gymnasium. And, you know, everybody was getting up and saying how grateful they were for this and how grateful they were for that. What's wrong with this? These people invited me back to their house for wassail and pie. Now, I was with somebody else, so they were driving. My car was on the other side of town, so I kind of, like, had to go. So I'm there, and all these so-called happy, joyous, and free alcoholics, you want to call them that? Oh, man. You know, who's thanking each other for this? And I'm grateful for that. And really, really. So give me my wassail, give me my pie, because I really got to get out of here. And what is wassail, anyway? Really? Really? What am I doing with these weirdos? They got to be doing something. These people have to be doing something. Whether it's a happy pill, smoking pot, whatever it is they're doing something. They're really doing something. I wasn't convinced that they weren't. It took me a little while. And my friend, this woman, who soon became my friend shortly thereafter, had this basket on her table, and it was full of seashells and rocks, and I picked one up, and it said, step three, turn it over. Step three, turn it over. Step three, turn it over. So I'm telling you, a good 15, 20 minutes, I'm playing with this rock, just turning it over, going, what the heck? What's going on? Boy. I gave you Christmas. I let you have Christmas, and I'll let those AA people have Christmas. And didn't do my customary, you know, Amaretta and whatever at midnight. Didn't do any of that stuff. Gave it to you. Made it through New Year's. White-knuckled New Year's. White-knuckled all of it. Now, in the meantime, I'm working in a liquor store. Working in a liquor store, and my boss was awesome. He was a great guy. He still is a great guy. You know, and all the AAs would come in before they're going to their, you know, meeting across the street if I happen to be working. And that coffee pot, the coffee pot in the corner of the liquor store where I worked, liquor and deli, wasn't just booze. I could justify anything. That coffee pot became a stabilizing force in my relationship to Alcoholics Anonymous. We 12-stepped many of people out of that corner. My boss was an incredible human being, and he allowed us to do a lot of stuff. There was a lot of stuff that took place in that deli. We twisted it and turned it, and I had read some of this, and I was doing some of this, and the doctor's opinion, and I could justify this, and I could work this out. And, you know, and this book says, I can go anywhere on God's good earth if my motives are correct. It says so. It says so. And I told my sponsor that, and I said, I'm going to such and such a bar tonight to listen to Irish music. My motives are correct. Because I gave you Thanksgiving playing with a rock. I gave you Christmas. Gave you New Year's. I was the DD New Year's Eve. I let all my drinking buddies drink, and I was the DD for New Year's Eve. So, St. Patrick's Day is mine. I'm going to the bar to listen to Irish music. And people came in, and they said, hey, send Maureen one. No. I'm doing that AA thing. No. Coca-Cola. Doing that AA thing. Somebody else would come in, another group, send one to Maureen. Celebrate St. Patrick's Day. No, I'm doing that AA thing. Coke. Want to buy me a Coke? Great. That only lasted so long. It really only lasted so long. So by the time my friend Eileen came in, and she was already pretty tore up, you know, okay, Eileen, I'm going to do my two now that AA lets me do. I'm going to do the two that AA lets me do. I'm just not allowed to get drunk. Well, two turned into 10, 10 turned into 12, 12 turns into 40, 40 turns into closing time. Closing time turns into having an accident in front of my home roof. I hit an IROC from behind. Clash! And police coming from every direction. And I only know this because of the police report. Because, again, I love blackouts. Love blackouts. So they chased me for about 4 hours. In this small little town, 1 mile by 1 mile, 1 mile by 1 mile, 1 mile long, 1 mile square. So they chased me for about 4 hours before they caught me. And I was placed under arrest finally, instead of being slapped on the wrist and sent home with a brother or a father or telling my uncle or telling my sisters or, you know. And the police officer who arrested me, he had actually gone to the academy with one of my brothers. And he said, I am placing you under arrest, and not because I don't want to help you, because you're Mike's little sister. I want to help you because you're Mike's little sister. And this is the only way I know to help you. So the next day I had to go and, tell my sister I had an accident and I had been arrested. But I knew that morning, that something had shifted when I went to go, and they wouldn't tell me where my car was, so they just gave me the keys to my car and my shoelaces and my socks and all that stuff, because they take it away from you. And they just told me it was down that end of town. You go find it. But it's down, they gave me a certain parameter. And when I realized that I had been arrested in front of a teacher's house that I greatly respected and admired, the incomprehensible demoralization again. And, I said that fine prayer that we all say, please God, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. And I knew something had shifted within me. I knew something had shifted. I knew the moment I uttered those words that something was going to be different. I knew that feeling of desperation, surrender, all of it, weight of the world, all of it, you name it, it happened in that one moment when I said, please God, I can't do this anymore. So I went and I told my sister about having the accident with the car, and she gave me this, I knew you were hopeless. I knew even those AA people couldn't help you, I knew that there was no hope for you. You are just going to die like this. You're just going to die. But I knew differently. And I went that night to my home group. The meeting itself was over, but they were having a group conscience meeting. And some of the women after the group conscience meeting took me to the diner. And we drank coffee until, 7 or 8 o'clock in the next morning when people had to go to work. And, and they told me there was some things I had to be willing to do right then and there. And I was. And, I've been willing ever since. You know, they told me I didn't have to do any of it. You don't have to do any of it. But if you want something better for yourself, we suggest you start here. You get a sponsor, you join a group, and you be of service to that group, and you keep it that simple. They made me keep it that simple. You don't drink, you go to meetings. Don't drink, go to meetings. The first year's a gift, they told me. First year's a gift. All you got to do is don't drink, go to meetings. Get a sponsor, get a group, be of service to that group. Be of service meant making coffee, washing ashtrays, putting away the tables and the chairs. And I showed up. I came early and I stayed late. I did exactly what they told me to do. I'm telling you, if they would have told me to go, you know, go pick asparagus or go steal some peaches or, you know, go, you know, they told me not to quit my job. We don't care that you work in a liquor store. You owe that man something, and you're going to be of service to him too. So again, it became an awesome, awesome environment. So they didn't, you know, they didn't want to hear how I felt. They didn't care how I felt. They just kept on asking me, do you want to get sober, stay sober, to be sober? Yes. Okay, then you go to a meeting. They didn't tell me 90 meetings in 90 days. They told me to go to a meeting every day. You go to a meeting every day. You go to a meeting every day. If I called my sponsor at the end of the day and said, ba-da-da-da-da-da, she'd say, what meeting did you go to? What meeting did you go to? And they said these stupid things. Even if your ass falls off. You don't drink and you go to a meeting. What does that mean? What did that mean? They told me not to play on the tracks. What do train tracks have to do with drinking? If you can't, don't play on the tracks, you won't get hit by a train. And then when I got to Virginia, they told me you have to ride all your horses. What does that mean? But here's what I learned. I learned that they were talking the language of the heart. I learned that I came to AA to save my ass. They spoke the language of the heart, and it saved my soul. It took me on this journey up to thine own self be true, exactly what we were talking about in the earlier meeting. These people with one thread, one single thread of hope, when I was finally honest with another human being, she took one thread and connected me and tethered me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Did I want you people to be the answer to my problem? Nope. Because the last thing I wanted was to hang around with you weirdos for the rest of my life. But there was an old guy in my home group called Bill Dwyer. Bill Dwyer was, he was 27, 28 years sober when I came in, and he became like a father figure to me, and he would say, kid, keep it simple. Kid. You only got to do it today. Kid. And then after 90 days, this is a 90-day pin, by the way. It's in New Jersey. There's a G on top and an AA on the bottom. And there's a little bitty dot in the middle. And they tell you at a 90-day ceremony that if you keep God in one hand and AA in the other, you won't have a hand to pick up a drink. And, you know, they have a pamphlet out called Wear It Pride. So the night he gave me, Bill Dwyer gave me my 90-day pin, he told me, okay, so here's $20, he said, I'm going to keep it in my wallet. And if you ever want your misery refunded, come and get me. I'll buy back your drunk. I'll buy it back for you. He said, because you don't have to do any of it. You don't have to do any of it. All you've done is proven yourself for 90 days you can do it a day at a time. And if you prove yourself you could do it one day, and then another day, and then another day, and then another day, there's no reason why you can't do it today. There's no reason why I can't do it today. There's no reason why I can't do it today. So again, then the service got bigger. You know, the 1 year passed, and the 2 year passes, and, you know, this woman named Maureen became my sponsor, and they called us Maureen Squared, and yeah, it was awesome. But, you know, again, with one single thread, she took me on a journey that puts my compass in the right direction. I don't know where your compass points. I have no idea. I don't know if anger causes you issues. You know, I don't know if procrastination causes you issues. You know, I used to say to Maureen, why put off till tomorrow what I can put off till next week? And don't rush me. I'm waiting for the last minute. Because if I wait for the last minute, then it only takes me a minute. I'm a good procrastinator. I'm good at it. I know what I'm good at. I know what they are. I know how to use them. I know how to rationalize them and justify them. to my own advantage. But when the pain is great enough and something is happening and something is going on, I also know where, when my ass falls off, where I better be. Where I better be. And I better be at some place where you people are willing to tell me the truth. I know who to call now. I know what to do now. You know, there is no reason for me to act. I'm not saying I don't do it in an unsober manner. Because getting sober and being sober is more than about not drinking. I can white knuckle this thing for the rest of my life. But do I want to be happy, joyous, and free? Do I want to be able to go to those places where, when my motives are correct, I can go anywhere on God's good earth? Absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. Nothing. You know, the first time I landed down here in Virginia, I kept, for months, said, what have I done? What have I done? You know, I went from the pace of New Jersey to the, no red light was passing, you know, to the screech world of Easy Does It. Oh boy, you know, standing in a grocery store between Billy Bob and his cousin Sue, and they want to talk about the rain gauge in Uncle Earl's house. Yeah. And Uncle Earl might live in Culpeper. And they use extra syllables in words. They stretch everything. Not just a mile. They stretch a word. So again, you know, again and again and again. So there's people in my home group now who I know will tell me the truth when I'm acting in or around in an unsober manner. Because again, I am no expert on this thing. Am I shooting for, you know, if I shoot to drive to New Jersey, I better start heading north. If I go, you know, west, I don't think I'm going to hit that target. But again, my path is on that, shooting for it. And most of the time, I can hit the goal today. Today. Because when I get home and I do a 10-step and I say, where was I selfish today? What have I done today to harm another? My sponsor told me there was only two spiritual laws that I was allowed to break or not break. Two spiritual laws that I could not break. Do no harm. And do no harm. So if I do no harm to my spiritual journey, there's nothing I can do to harm yours. But if I do harm to your spiritual journey, then I've busted mine. So again, clean house, trust God, help others. It's that simple. It doesn't get any easier than that. And I'm practicing these principles in every one of my affairs. I don't just pick and choose, and if a farm use vehicle pulls in front of me anymore, I don't cuss him out. Because where are those people who drive farm use things? Where have they come from, and what are they doing in front of me? Land of Easy Does It. Whoa. But again, if I'm practicing these principles at work, even if my boss angers me, as long as I do no harm, I can't cause harm. The clerk at Walmart during a Christmas rush isn't going fast enough. As long as I cause no harm, I can't cause harm. It really is that simple. You know, a friend of mine's going through this really, really horrendous divorce. You know, and the soon-to-be ex is just pushing buttons, kicking tires, dropping bombs, you name it, he's going to try it. And, you know, and to sit back and watch or to take a hand and walk through and, you know, I think to myself, don't drink and go to meetings. Don't drink and go to meetings, because even if your ass falls off, don't drink and go to meetings. And she's not convinced that that's the answer. And she doesn't have just, you know, a couple of 24s at this thing. And it's like, so last week she finally got to a really good meeting, and she said, you know what, maybe you're right. The answer is don't drink, go to meetings. And I hate with the, I told you so. I told you so! Because no matter what's happening, if I am surrounded by you people, there's no way I can't progress. There's no way I can't listen to what the 10 people shared in the earlier meeting and not be able to put that into practice in my own life and not get this much better today. This much better. This much is progress. I don't have to have the big giant leaps and bounds anymore, but this much better is progress. This much. This much. And if I've done some kind of harm today, all right, I'm gonna tell the truth. If I do some kind of harm, sometimes it takes me a Virginia minute to admit. I might do the harm in a New York minute, but it takes me that Virginia minute to admit it. But I don't like to make amends. So it's a whole lot easier not to do the harm. It's a whole lot easier. So it doesn't matter whether it's my boss, whether it's the little old lady next door who drives me crazy. But again, I am there to be of service. I rent her house. So, I'm of service. You know, I don't cause harm to her property in any way. I'm not ducking my landlord in any way. I don't have to run from the police anymore. I don't have to run from the legal issues and the health issues and moral obligations. I'm only morally obligated to me. What does my moral compass tell me to do? What does my moral compass say? You know, back in the good old days, I was as sick as my secrets. And I had a lot of them because I didn't want you to know what kind of slug I was. I didn't want you to know that I was the skank that slept under the bridge. I didn't want you to know that, you know, I was the, you know, the one who stole the 20 off of the top of the bar. I want you to know that, so I'm going to help you look for it. You know, I didn't want you to know about the lying, cheating, manipulating, conniving, insane stuff that I was doing. You know, there was a guy in New Jersey who used to say, you know, if I was a horse thief and you took away the horse, what does it make me? You know, my sponsor used to say, just because we've taken the alcohol away doesn't make you a non-alcoholic. There are certain functions in your brain that doesn't fire properly. You have to act your way into right action. You have to take the action in order to change the thinking. I can't change the thinking in order to produce an action. I had to change the action in order to... What are you people talking about? You drove me nuts. You drove me nuts. And again, my sponsor would say to me, well, it's in the book. It's in the book. Does anybody know how many musts are in the first 164 pages? It's in the book. You don't have to do any of it. But if you want what we have, you'll be willing to go to any lengths to get it. There is 57 musts. 57 musts in the first 164 pages. You must, or it will kill you. You must. It says, resentment. You must get rid of it, or it will kill you. Must. My sponsor was big on these one word, stupid little phrases. Must. Demands. Doesn't say it asks for rigorous honesty. It doesn't say you can if you want to be. It says it demands rigorous honesty. She was so big on these one little words. Really? More? Really? Really? You better learn to say we. You do too many I's. I do. We. Such a big word. Now we celebrate we-ness, don't we, Sarah? We-ness. We-ness. I was at a meeting a couple of years ago, and this guy said, for lack of a better word, he said, I am so grateful for the we-ness in this room. I lost it. I could not. I was hurting myself, trying not to laugh out loud and disrupt the rest of the meeting. I was hurting myself. And I said, Jim just said, for lack of a better word, we-ness. And now we use we-ness. We use the term we-ness. For lack of a better word, that's a great word. There's no lack of a better word. We-ness is a great word. And we use it. We play with we-ness. What are you going to do today? We're going to go have some we-ness. That's right. Because they told me that I would not be able to cry myself sober, but I would be able to laugh myself back to being healthy. Again, we-ness, we-ness, we-ness. Are you guys really taping this? We-ness, we-ness. No. But again, they were all about these one little words. praying only. 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 I didn't get to pray for a new car, new toys, new boat, $1 million, winning the lottery, you know, you breaking a leg, you breaking an arm, you just being taken out totally. Praying only. Only. Really? 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 A couple of years ago, my roommate and I from New Jersey moved down here together. She came into sobriety in 1994. I was a couple of years sober. She asked me to help her on this journey. And in 1997, she had decided to move here to Virginia to start taking care of her father. And, you know, he was breaking his shoulder, had broken a hip. So she was moving down here. She was putting her house up for sale and moving down here. And I started looking for a new roommate. And I said, you know what? Why don't I go try out Virginia? So we got to Virginia. I was only going to stay a year, maybe two. I'm here 17. I do really good math. But slightly thereafter, you know, after we got here and we realized her parents were in okay shape, you know, but they did need help and assistance. So she had decided to go back to school, and she went back to college. Randolph-Macon was still a woman's college then, and she was going to seek her degree. And I took a job with an international corporation, figuring that when she graduated from college, her and I could go and really roam the world. You know, she was taking a creative writing, got a creative writing, English major, minor, whatever. And she was diagnosed in 2005, in January 2005, with breast cancer. She was about to graduate. So she did. She walked in May. But the morning of her graduation, you know, my friends from New Jersey came down to be part of the celebration. We went from her graduation in the morning to a AA, friend of ours, AA, son's funeral in the afternoon. What a gift. What a gift. You know, they wanted to talk about the grace of God and the will of God today. I am surrounded by grace on a regular basis. I have not missed grace in 20-some-odd years. 20-some-odd years, I have been surrounded by grace. And for the first 10, I didn't see it. I couldn't see it. I was incapable of seeing it because it was still all about self, 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 self. See, in New Jersey, they say it takes 5 years to get your brains back and another 5 to learn how to use them. It took me a little longer than that because I'm sick. I'm twisted. I can rationalize and justify all of it. You know, one of my first Christmas celebrating with my sponsor, she had a couple of steps in her living room, and I was sitting there Christmas morning. I was sitting on the two steps, and her husband came over and handed me a box, and I kind of like dropped the box. It was heavy. And I said to them, "What's in here, a brick?" And they all laughed, because there was a brick in there. Okay, granted, it was a decorative brick. It was, you know, shaped like a couch, and it had shamrocks on it, and it played "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling." Decorative brick. Still a brick from my sponsor. And again, it became a standing joke, you know. So when Judith got sick and graduated, she was diagnosed at stage 4. So we didn't know. So a day at a time, 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 we came from Lynchburg to UVA, a day at a time. And we probably did it a lot of days in those 4.5 years. There was a lot of days I was but here's one of the highlights I want to hit. She did really well. She did really well. Friday the 13th just passed. So in 08, it was a Friday the 13th, and the breast cancer had gone to her brain. So here was my creative writing, English major roommate who taught me how to use $10 words and $20 words. You know, I mean, she really taught me. She used to give me the grammar lessons. She gave them to Kelly, too, by the way. She gave Kelly grammar lessons, too. So again, we're traveling back and forth to UVA, and the brain tumor happened, and she did okay. We did all right. We did all right because the people in this fellowship rallied and took good care of me so I could take good care of her, and it was an awesome couple of years. So after that brain tumor hit, and she started to have this aphasia problem and all these other things and all this other stuff, she had a seizure in May of 2009 that really started to break her body down. But I remember calling up the UVA and her doctor saying, just get her here, get her here, get her here. I said, Dr. Brennan, they won't release her, they won't release her, they won't release her. You got to do it, you got to do it. She said, give me the phone, give them, put them on the phone. So I gave her the phone and she said, she took the phone back and she said, how do you want to travel? Do you think she needs a helicopter? I said, I don't care if you send a Batmobile. Get her out of here. Get her up there. So we get up to UVA, and I get out of the car, and the ambulance is pulling in, and they're pulling her out. And Dr. Brennan meets me at the door, and she said, Judith is being taken care of. You need to tell me what it is I need to do for you. What is it I need to do for you? I said, Dr. Brennan, if you could get me an AA meeting list, that's what you could do for me. That's what you could do for me. She said, you stay right here. Do not move from this spot. Judith is being taken care of. Do not move. The next thing I knew, two women came up beside me, introduced themselves. Then a guy came up, introduced himself. And another guy came up and introduced himself. And they were four members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they took me into the cafeteria, and they bought me a cup of coffee. And they were able to answer my questions and say to me, your ass is falling off, but it's okay, because we're going to help you put it back on. So in the meantime, that gave me the idea to be able to call my friends in Lynchburg, to tell my friends in Lynchburg what's happening, what's going on, to call my family in New Jersey, who now wanted to hear from me on a regular basis. They wanted me to be part of their lives. They were influenced by how I'm making decisions, doing things, being of service to another human being. It's the greatest journey I've ever been on in my life. The greatest journey I've ever been on in my life is to put somebody else before me. Don't get me wrong, people. There were some horrendous moments in there. But I can tell you this. I have not had a bad day in a long time. And there have been some horrendous things that have happened. Horrendous. I lost my sponsor, my friend Peggy, and my friend Judith within an 11-month period from 2008 to 2009. And again, I've seen people in this fellowship bury brothers and sisters in this fellowship. It's hard. It's hard to be so connected and so tight with another human being and carry that person to their final resting place. It's hard. I've seen people in this fellowship bury their spouses and their parents. I went on a graduation morning from Judas graduation to watch a guy in his fellowship bury his 15-year-old son. And people do that without drinking. So who am I? Who am I? Because I have witnessed grace. I see grace today. I feel grace. I see grace. I know grace. I recognize grace. And it's on each and every one of your faces right here. Because without you people, I don't have any grace. Without you people, I got nothing. And I don't care whether you're in New Jersey, you're in San Diego. We were in San Diego for the convention in 1995. Ran into a friend of mine that used to get, was a member of my home group up there. And, you know, he'd moved to California. So I ran into Eric and we're chatting and chatting and chatting. Now there's 70,000 recovering alcoholics. 70,000 recovering alcoholics at the San Diego convention. And I left Eric and I went down to go get some coffee or whatever we were doing, and we were going to go do this, we were going to go do this, and go there and just running like a wild banshee through this convention because the energy was just so intense. So Eric ran into my sponsor and her husband, and they said, he said, I saw Maureen a little while ago, and she's just all full of this energy, and she's just running and hopping and jumping and carrying on. And John said, oh, really, where'd you see her? We're looking for her. He said, shh. 70,000 recovering alcoholics, and they could hear me. Yeah, buddies. So again, the night of my mother's death, my alcoholism took me and plunged me into a place that I never, ever, ever want to experience going again. And March the 17th is my mother's birthday. So there's no coincidences. There's absolutely nothing that happens by God's in God's world by mistake. But I would like to finish with this because, you know, always want to go to the book. And it says so in the appendix. Right. Did somebody move it? Somebody's always moving this stuff around, man. I don't care what anybody says. They move it. Because the last time I read something out of here, it was different than last week when I read it again. In the appendix, the AA tradition, tradition one, it says, to those now in its fold, Alcoholics Anonymous has made the difference between misery and sobriety, and often the difference between life and death. AA can, of course, mean just as much to the uncounted alcoholics not yet reached. Therefore, no society of men and women ever had a more urgent need for continuous effectiveness and permanent unity. We alcoholics see that we must work together and hang together, else most of us will finally die alone. Thank you all for being a part of my permanent unity, because I can't do this without you. I can't do this without you. And thank you for having me today.